Okay. I can see that we don't follow instructions very well, me included. It's 10 minutes after when I said we would restart, but I think having networking opportunities and dialogue is part of the value of this event, so I don't want to discourage that either. So let's get right to the next item on the agenda, and that is something that we've already touched on numerous times, and that is the importance of communication. And communicating about food safety is a challenge. We all know that. We all have great ideas about how to do it better. We all recognize that there are plenty of limitations in the way that we've done it in the past. We've got with us today, and I'm really pleased to be able to have him on the agenda today, Dr. Peter Sandman. And Peter is someone who we recently met earlier this year at a seminar. I think Linda Kuhn met Peter at a seminar over at Guelph back in the spring of this year, and recognized the value that that he could bring to our organization. So we've been talking with Peter numerous times over the last 6 or 8 months about how we can do a better job of communicating. He is probably one of the preeminent risk communications consultants in the world, working on a variety of issues such as H1N1. He's consulting with a variety of international agencies, and in addition has done a lot of work with the Canadian government on risk communications. I think he'll share with us today what I think is a very engaging and interesting presentation and dialogue about how we can do a better job at communication. So with that, I'll turn it over to Peter.
Thank you. I'm on a cordless microphone, am I?
Yes,
I am. Because I don't like podiums much, and I also don't like PowerPoints. I think they're the work of the devil. So they actually found me an overhead projector. All over the world, I have clients with overhead projectors in the basement with a little sign on them saying, "Don't throw away Sandman uses." I would like to do two things today. One is to give you a quick primer on risk communication generically. And the other is to cherry pick a few implications of that primer, a few strategies of risk communication, and give you a couple of risk communication examples that come out of food safety issues. There will be no Q&A at the end, because I'll just keep talking until Randy says, "Enough already, shut up." So if you have any comments or questions, please feel free to ask them at any time. But don't wait until I stop talking, because that won't happen. Okay, and I think the place to start is with the number. It's the only number I'm going to give you, so those of you who are techies and like numbers get the most out of this number. It's all words from here on in. If you make a long list of hazards and rank order them in order of something like expected annual mortality, how many people they kill in a good year, and then you take the same list of hazards and you rank order them in order of how upsetting they are to people, the correlation between the two rank orders is approximately 0.2. Those of you who have studied statistics may remember you can square a correlation coefficient to get the percentage of variance accounted for. If you square 0.2, you get 0.04, a glorious 4% of the variance. Or, and here it is without numbers, the risks that kill people and the risks that upset people are completely different. If you know a risk is dangerous, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's upsetting. If you know a risk is upsetting, that tells you almost nothing about whether it's dangerous. That incredibly low 0.2 correlation is very close to a universal. If you use morbidity instead of mortality, you're not killing people, you're just hurting them or making them sick, the correlation between morbidity and public concern is also 0.2. Ecosystem damage, 0.2. Economic damage, 0.2. It doesn't matter what your measure of harm is. Whatever your measure of harm, across a wide range of hazards, the correlation between how much harm that hazard is doing and how upset some public gets about it is this absurdly low 0.2 correlation. The key intellectual question in risk communication is, why is the correlation so low? The key practical question in risk communication is, how do we get it higher? How do we get people more concerned when a risk is serious and less concerned when a risk is trivial? Maybe 20 years ago or so, trying to make sense out of this very low correlation, I coined terminology that has become standard for me and fairly standard in the field of risk communication. So let me introduce you to it quickly. I said, all right, let's take the concept of risk and let's partition it into its two principal components. Let's define what technical people mean by risk, which, as many of you know, is basically magnitude times probability. How bad is it times how often does it happen? Let's call that hazard. And then let's take what the public means by risk, all the things that normal people consider part of the risk, and risk assessors define out of the equation. And I'll take this concept apart in a minute, but for the moment, let's think of it as one thing and call it outrage. Which leads to the formula that sent my children to college, and may ultimately send my grandchildren to college. I said, properly considered, risk is equal to hazard plus outrage. Now, technical people hate this formula. They hate that plus sign. They find it terribly imprecise. They mutter, that's what happens when you let an English major write a formula. So for the techies in the room, and I know there are some, I have an alternative definition. I would suggest that risk is a function of hazard and outrage. Okay. If you don't know what that means, that's hazard plus outrage in techie code. And this is a redefinition that makes a difference, and I want to make sure everybody understands why. The way the problem is usually seen, and remember, the problem is this miserable 0.2 correlation between whether you're going to hurt people and whether you're going to upset people. The way that problem is usually seen is as a problem of public misperception. And so my clients spend a lot of time complaining that the public just doesn't get it, just doesn't understand, just doesn't perceive the risk correctly. What this redefinition does is suggest something very different and much more symmetrical. What I'm arguing is that the experts, when they look at a risk, focus on the hazard and ignore the outrage. The experts therefore systematically overestimate the risk when the hazard is high and the outrage is low. And the experts systematically underestimate the risk when the hazard is low and the outrage is high, because all they're doing is looking at the hazard. The public makes exactly the opposite mistake. The public focuses on the outrage and ignores the hazard. The public, therefore, overestimates the risk when the outrage is high and the hazard is low. And the public underestimates the risk when the outrage is low and the hazard is high. What I'm arguing is that this 0.2 correlation, far from being the result of public misperception, is, in fact, the result of a definitional dispute. I'm arguing that 0.2 is the genuine correlation between hazard and outrage. Two nearly independent variables that have, in fact, only one interesting thing in common. They're both called risk by different groups of people. Well, they have one other interesting thing in common, and that is this. When outrage is high, perceived hazard will be high also. When outrage is low, perceived hazard will be low. That is, if you think of this as a correlation matrix, the correlation between hazard and outrage is very low, 0.2. The correlation between hazard and hazard perception is similarly low. But the correlation between outrage and hazard perception is quite high. Those of you who like numbers, it's about 0.7, accounting for, roughly half the variance. Well, whenever you have a high correlation, the question you ask if you're any kind of scientist at all is, what's the direction of the causality? So as we look at the high correlation between outrage and hazard perception, what we're asking is this: are people upset about a risk because they think it's dangerous? Or do people think it's dangerous because they're upset? That's an important distinction. If they're upset because they think it's dangerous and you think they're mistaken, the solution is to convince them that it's not dangerous. Okay? If they think it's dangerous because they're upset, the solution is to stop upsetting them. Okay. So if you want to manage this system, you need to know its causal structure. You don't want to be in the embarrassing position of trying to influence the cause by manipulating the effect. That's not good science, and it's not good risk communication either. So there's been a lot of research on this, and I'm going to give you the answer, but let me test your intuition first. Raise your hand if you think that for the most part, hazard perception causes outrage. People decide that something is dangerous for whatever reason, and that gets them upset. How many of you think that outrage causes hazard perception? People get upset for whatever reason, and that makes them think it's dangerous. Okay? About an equal number of hands, and you're all right, but the second group is much more right than the first group. In the research on this, it's a cycle. There are arrows in both directions, but the arrow from outrage to hazard perception is very strong, very robust. The arrow from hazard perception to outrage is quite weak. For the most part, in other words, it is not true, that people get upset because they think a risk is dangerous. It's much more true that people think a risk is dangerous because they're upset. Outrage is the engine of hazard perception. Hazard perception is not the engine of outrage, and actual hazard has virtually nothing to do with either one. You had a comment? Oh, absolutely. If you don't interrupt, you'll never get a word in. Yes, that's very often true. I mean, outrage is labile, to use the psychiatric term. It's fungible, to use the economic term. Outrage floats easily from one object to another. And, you know, you can try and manage that flow. There is, you know, what I, with some grandiosity, call a law of conservation of outrage. I mean, outrage is neither created nor destroyed. It's just reallocated. People have as much outrage as they have. I mean, you know, the Greeks were right. You're either splenetic or you're, you know, whatever the four humors are. They are what they are, and you are who you are. And you're either constantly worried or you're constantly angry or you're pretty placid, but you're, you know, that doesn't change much. But it gets reapplied. So, you know, when we're trying to get people upset about a risk, we're competing. We might want them upset about the pandemic flu, or we might want them upset about food safety. The Christian right wants them upset about gay marriage. The environmental movement wants them upset about global warming. And, you know, there's no way to get them more upset about X without getting them less upset about Y. You don't know what Y is going to be. But it's certainly true that outrage floats. And therefore, what you're saying is also true, that sometimes it floats to you, for reasons that have more to do with who you are than with what you're doing, or for reasons that have more to do with where you are, you're just in the wrong place at the wrong time, than even with who you are. So I think your comment's absolutely right. Other comments? Yes. All right, well, so, yeah, and some of this is change over time, but most of this is, you know, we really don't want to get pissed off at God. Getting pissed off at the church is not quite the same thing as getting pissed off at God, but it's uncomfortably close. Getting pissed off at Maple Leaf, I mean, I understand that Michael might confuse these two, getting pissed off at Maple Leaf is relatively safe, you know. I mean, there's no question that you're right. Okay, very quickly, just to put a little meat on the bones of what outrage is, here's a list of, and if you have trouble reading this, if your eyes are as old as mine, this is in one of the handouts. This is a list of outrage components. The columns are labeled safe and risky rather than low outrage and high outrage in order to dramatize my conviction that low outrage is in fact one way of being safe. And high outrage is one way of being risky. Low hazard is a different way of being safe, and high hazard is a different way of being risky. So what I'm arguing is that if a risk is voluntary, natural, familiar, not memorable, not dreaded, and so on down the safe side of the list, people are going to shrug it off even if it kills them. And if a risk is coerced, industrial, exotic, memorable, and so on down the risky side, people are going to be very worried about it and upset about it, even if it's doing very little harm. And this is a list which one uses diagnostically to figure out how high the outrage in a particular situation is likely to be. So that you can decide whether to buy that other company or whether to introduce that new product. It's also, of course, a strategy for figuring out how to manage outrage. You begin to analyze where it's coming from, which of the components on this list are giving you the most trouble, which of the components on this list are more subject to management. Management up or management down? I mean, activists try to manage outrage up, for reasons that I assume are obvious, but so do food safety people when they're trying to persuade publics to take risks more seriously. And on the other hand, when you're convinced that people are taking a particular risk altogether too seriously, then you're trying to manage the outrage down. And a list like this gives you a handle on either of those tasks. Based on all of that, let me very quickly for you introduce the kinds of risk communication by graphing hazard against outrage. And I want to point your attention first to the lower right-hand corner. These are the high hazard, low outrage risks. You know, driving without a seatbelt, eating too much, exercising too little. The risks that are responsible for lots of mortality and very little outrage. And this is the venue of what I call precaution advocacy. And the core, for reasons I hope are obvious given what we've said already, the core of precaution advocacy is to increase the outrage. You're not trying to increase the outrage for the fun of it. You're trying to increase the outrage, which may mean increasing the fear, or if the word fear terrifies you, you can replace concern, its wimpy cousin. It may mean increasing other emotions that input into outrage, but you're trying to get people to take the risk more seriously. And the intellectual understanding here is if you can increase the outrage, you will increase the hazard perception. If you increase the hazard perception, you will increase people's inclination to take precautions or demand that others take precautions, that, a company take precautions, or that a government agency like CFIA regulate more strenuously. So is it possible to do precaution advocacy without increasing outrage? Yeah, it is possible. It's just very hard. I have a lot of clients that say, in fact, I was with a client all last week working on what you guys insist on calling H1N1, and I like to call the pandemic. What my clients are endlessly saying is we want people to be more concerned and we want people to take precautions, but we don't want to frighten them. But it's a little bit like saying, I want to write a novel, but I don't want to use the letter E. It is possible. It has, in fact, been done. But it's a hell of a handicap. In the opposite corner are the risks that are high outrage, low hazard. And this is the venue of what I call outrage management. And in exactly the same way, and for the same reasons, the core of outrage management is to get people less upset, less outraged. If you can reduce the outrage, you will reduce the hazard perception. You will reduce people's inclination to take unnecessary precautions or to demand that you take unnecessary precautions. Now, this is obviously a game all people can play, so there are often situations where some stakeholders are doing outrage management and others are doing precaution advocacy because they disagree, whether they disagree based on the profit motive or they disagree based on ideology or they disagree based on their interpretation of data. I will leave that to your judgment. But the point is that, on an endless range of issues, consider genetically modified food as a good example of a food issue, where, you know, Greenpeace is actively doing precaution advocacy, saying, for God's sake, take GM foods more seriously. And Monsanto is doing outrage management, saying this is no big deal. Stop worrying about genetically modified foods. Please become apathetic again. And that's as it should be. They are both doing what they ought to be doing, given their assessment of the hazard. Does this make sense so far? The paradigm of precaution advocacy is watch out. This could kill you. Do something. Wear a seatbelt. Wear a hard hat. Not necessarily both at the same time. Wear a condom, but probably not at the same time. But if watch out is the paradigm in precaution advocacy, in outrage management, the paradigm is calm down. Oh, they're both hard to do. They're both hard to do. It is very hard to get apathetic people upset, and once you have succeeded, it is very hard to put the genie of outrage back in the bottle and get them to calm down again. They are both extremely difficult. They're difficult in completely different ways, Linda, but, you know, I mean, the strategies are non-overlapping, so that these are two completely different toolkits. You can be good at both at the same time in the same way that you can be a good carpenter and a good electrician at the same time, but you better know the difference. You know, if you start hammering nails into circuits, you're going to make things worse. And similarly, the strategies of outrage management and the strategies of precaution advocacy are essentially non-overlapping. They have nothing in common. Okay. Up here in the upper right-hand corner, we have the risks that are high hazard, high outrage. This is the venue of crisis communication. Now, be careful. Companies normally call what I'm calling outrage management crisis communication because it's a crisis for the company. You know, people are very upset. That's a crisis for you. Your crisis is that they wrongly think they have a crisis. Did everybody follow that? Okay. But when they rightly think they have a crisis, that is, when they are upset and they're right to be upset because the hazard is non-trivial, then you're in a different venue entirely. Then you're in genuine crisis communication. There is no arrow to draw. It would be absurd to try to reduce the outrage because the outrage is justified and you need the outrage to motivate precaution. It's unnecessary to try to increase the outrage. It is already commensurate with the hazard. Which is the goal in risk communication, to get outrage that's commensurate with the hazard. However, there's still a lot of communicating to be done. If the paradigm in precaution advocacy is watch out, the paradigm in outrage management is calm down. Okay. Now, the message isn't calm down in outrage management. Why not? What happens when you tell outraged people to calm down? They get more outraged. You know, so calm down is not a useful message, but it is the paradigm. Your goal is to get them calmer at some future date. But the paradigm in crisis communication is we'll get through this together. Okay? The core of crisis communication is to help people bear their outrage. In precaution advocacy, you're trying to increase it. In outrage management, you're trying to decrease it. In crisis communication, you're trying to help them bear it. And the reason you want to help them bear it is if they can bear it, then you can guide them to take wise rather than unwise precautions. They will be motivated by their outrage to take precautions, but they won't necessarily be motivated to take the right one. Okay? And trying to persuade them that if they're worried about the pandemic flu, it is wiser for them to avoid contact with people with the flu than to avoid contact with pork requires some crisis communication effort in order to help them bear the outrage so that they can direct it wisely. Does that make sense to everybody? Just to finish this map very quickly, down in the lower left-hand corner, I'm not going to draw a circle. I have not found that to be a business opportunity. In low hazard, low outrage situations, there's very little communicating to be done. What would you say to people? Congratulations on your apathy. You're absolutely right. This is trivial. So very little to be done there. And in the middle, there is what I call the sweet spot. People are interested enough to listen, but they're not freaking out. The outrage is, at an optimal level for attention. The hazard is serious enough that you want to give them time, but not so serious that you have more important things to do than talk to them. You're busy inoculating them or evacuating them or whatever. And in the sweet spot, it's a genuine kind of risk communication. Real work gets done there, but it's easy. In the three corners, it's hard, and it's hard in entirely different ways. Okay, based on that, that was the primer. I hope it's obvious. I mean, if there's a single takeaway here, the takeaway is whenever you're facing a risk communication task, figure out where you are on the map. How high is the hazard, in your opinion? How high is the outrage? And that one you can measure. It's easier to measure outrage than hazard. How high is the hazard likely to get so that you can get ahead of these things? How high is the outrage likely to get? And based on your answer to those four questions, you know whether you need your precaution advocacy toolkit or your outrage management toolkit or your crisis communication toolkit. And then having done that, do it again a month later. Because situations change. In a typical crisis, for example, before the crisis, you're doing precaution advocacy. In the middle of the crisis, you're doing crisis communication. After the crisis, you're doing outrage management. So you need to kind of keep up. Michael? I'm going to talk very, very briefly about a few applications, a few aspects of the toolkit for all three. And if you really want the toolkit, I need more than 45 minutes. But I should say, that if you're finding this stuff interesting, use the handouts, which has more than I'm covering. And you'll notice on the bottom of the handouts is a section called For More on My Take on This Issue, which sends you to various specific URLs of my website. My goal in life is to get everything I know onto my website and retire. I'm not there yet, so if you want to hire me, you can, but you don't have to. It's almost all on the website. And if you're willing to learn by reading rather than by, listening and then writing a check, it's all there for free in enormous detail. Because I'm not interested in having any trade secrets. Okay, let me cherry pick a few implications in each of the three interesting corners. Say a few things about food safety, precaution advocacy, food safety outrage management, and food safety risk communication. We have now gone beyond the handouts because now I'm just going to give you specific examples. One thing I want to say about food safety precaution advocacy is increasing people's fear is the single most powerful tool of precaution advocacy. Fear has had a bad press. There's a lot of fear of fear among public officials, which is why when I work with public officials, I have to work with terms like concern, which is sort of fear light, and which public officials, they're willing to countenance the possibility of arousing concern, but you talk about arousing fear and they get terrified. There are, of course, there are legitimate commercial questions. I mean, the very interesting question that I can't give a good answer to right now is how do you make people more fear of risks associated with your product without making them more fearful of your product itself? That's a big question. It has some partial answers, but they're very complicated, and I'm going to save them for another time. But I did want to tag that, you know, if you want to do food safety communication, you probably want to make people more afraid of food pathogens, but you don't want to make them more afraid of food. And the question is, how do you do that? And there are answers to that question. The main thing I want to leave you with about fear is fear works when people are apathetic. Now, if people aren't apathetic, if people are in denial, for example, denial is very different from apathy, although it masquerades as apathy. You know, if people are apathetic and you frighten them, they get more worried. If people are in denial and you frighten them, they go more deeply into denial. So I don't think food risk denial is something I've encountered, but I've certainly encountered denial working on nuclear issues. I've encountered denial working on some kinds of chemical issues, where the problem isn't that people are apathetic, it's that they're acting apathetic because they're too frightened to bear to think about it. There are some drawbacks to frightening people, but it's certainly basic. Let me mention that education is not basic, and I hope that's clear, given that, you know, outrage leads to hazard perception doesn't lead to outrage. Educating people about the hazard is not a very useful way of making them more responsive to risks you want them to take more seriously. Until you have aroused some outrage. And when you have aroused some outrage, people become very interested in acquiring information to justify their outrage. We are much more rationalizers as a species than we are rational. If you get us worried about something, we will absorb information to tell us we're right to worry. But we're not very interested in that information until after we become worried. Although education is not terribly useful, training, it turns out, is. The difference between training and education is about stuff, and training is about how to do stuff. And it turns out that training people to take precautions is often much more effective than trying to persuade them that they ought to take precautions. And that's true for two reasons. One is you can teach people how to do something, and the very fact that they know how to do it will, as a result of cognitive dissonance, make them more inclined to think they ought to do it. So when you give people skills, they want to use those skills. And, you know, if you teach someone how to make the kitchen safer, they become better at making the kitchen safe, but they also become more interested in having a safer kitchen. Okay? If you tell them they ought to have, and here's the second reason, when you tell people they ought to worry more about food risk, insofar as they feel like they don't know what to do, insofar as they feel low efficacy about addressing the problem, that becomes a motivation not to take the problem seriously. I did years ago a lot of work on radon risk, and we would try to persuade people to test their homes for radon, and it turns out one of the main reasons people were reluctant to test their homes for radon is you'd knock on their door and say, you know, you might have radon in under your house, and it rises into your house, it causes lung cancer, you should test your house for radon. And people were thinking, oh Jesus, test my house for radon. I wasn't very good in science in high school. I bet it needs a Bunsen burner. And a sense that I don't know how was people, especially male people, don't tell you I don't know how. They tell you I think that's bullshit. I'm not interested. This is similarly a big issue within the food industry with regard to employees taking precautions seriously. If they feel like they don't know how, they will tell themselves the precaution is silly. They won't tell themselves or you that they don't know how. God, there's so much more I could say about this. Let me make one more point about precaution advocacy. Anger is a very good tool as well. I mentioned fear was a good tool. It turns out that anger is very conducive to fear. Activists obviously understand this. If they can get you angry about something, you will take that about a risk. You will take that risk much more seriously. And this goes back to points that were made early on by others that people worried about food risk are often not so much worried about the food as angry at the company that manufactured the food. And the link between anger and fear is very robust. If you can get people angry at somebody, it's much easier to get them to take the risk seriously. And that's all I'm going to say about precaution advocacy. For God's sake, don't get the impression that that's all there is to say about precaution advocacy. But that's a potpourri of a couple of strategies. Outrage management in the food industry. One very significant piece of outrage management is sharing control. People feel less outrage when they feel a sense of control. Let me test this. Okay? Think about driving. And I would like you to raise your hand if you feel safer behind the wheel of a car than you do in the passenger seat. Okay. Nearly all the hands are up, and that's consistent with the data. I don't have Canadian data. In the U.S., 85% of all people with driver's licenses consider themselves better than average drivers. Yeah, obviously, only 50% can be better than average. The other 50% are worse than average. So that's a 35% optimistic bias hooked to control. If I'm driving, I feel safe. If you're driving, I feel less safe. If you want me to feel safe, let me drive. Okay? Or let me help drive. Or if you can't bear to even let my fingers get onto the steering wheel, at the very least, let me backseat drive. Let me sit at the back seat, in the back seat, and yell at you that you're a crappy driver. And even that will significantly reduce my outrage. The problem, of course, is that sharing control, while it reduces your stakeholders' outrage, tends to increase your outrage. There's a zero-sum game operating, and the question is, who do you most want to calm down, the people who are excessively worried about this risk, or yourself? And I have a lot of clients that are very reluctant to share control because they are managing their own outrage rather more assiduously than they are managing their stakeholders' outrage. I should mention, it's probably obvious, but I should mention one strategy for sharing control is labeling. And I know that there are real drawbacks to labeling, among them that you don't want a 10-foot label on a 3-inch product. So I do understand the limitations of labeling, but the evidence is very clear that labeling is a twofer. Okay? That is, as a tool of precaution advocacy, labeling is a way of giving people information that helps them understand that something is a risk. That's problematic because it's speaking much more to the hazard than it is to the outrage, but it does some good as a tool of precaution advocacy. It also does good as a tool of outrage management. That is, the label reduces people's outrage about the fact that the manufacturer has failed to eliminate the risk. I've worked on labeling with the cell phone industry, which resisted putting in labels, and it's a nice example because the labels they put on cell phones on field strength are, as far as we know, completely irrelevant to the possible risk that attaches to cell phones. No evidence whatever that the numbers on cell phone packaging around the world that tell you how strong a cell phone you have. There's really no evidence that connects to cancer, but there's a lot of evidence. There's also very little evidence that people use that number in any meaningful way, but there's a lot of evidence that people are reassured by the number. Similarly, earlier on, it's a very similar industry, I worked with electromagnetic fields for the power utilities around the world, and one of the things we discovered is that if people are worried about EMFs from transmission lines, you come to their house with a Gauss meter. And you walk through their house with a Gauss meter and you measure the field strength in their bedroom and you measure the field strength in the kids' room and you measure the field strength in the backyard. And it turns out it makes absolutely no difference what the measures are. The very fact that you're in their house with a Gauss meter reduces outrage substantially. It is a labeling. I mean, it's a problem if the hazard is high and the labeling reduces outrage. You might not want to reduce outrage. If the hazard is low and you're trying to keep people calm, sharing control is a powerful tool, and labeling helps share control. A second food outrage management principle, emphasize improvements and give credit to critics. What usually happens in food risk controversies, and in fact in all risk controversies, is this. Activists mobilize pressure for change. Okay. The change happens. That pressure may be directly on industry. The pressure may be on regulators. I don't have evidence with regard to food. Brian, you'll probably be glad that I don't. But I have a lot of evidence from the environmental arena that environmental regulation has a much stronger correlation with outrage than with hazard. That is, EPA and environmental regulators around the world regulate the environmental risks that people are upset about much more reliably than the environmental risks that people, that actually endanger people. You'll be glad to know that hazard also has a significant input to the regression equation. You know, hazard doesn't not have any effect, but outrage is the biggie in the regression equation. Everybody understand what that means? So what normally happens is activists demand change or the public demands change, and they either get directly to the company or they get to the regulator, and either way the change happens. And that's the system, as far as I'm concerned, working the way it should. You know, I'm not as enthusiastic as some of you are about government and industry getting together all by themselves and doing their own continual improvement without public input. I'm inclined to think that, you know, your continual improvement will keep continuing only as long as the public continues to be dissatisfied. And you'll find better things to do than food safety if you have a complacent public. That's what 40 years of as a risk communicator has taught me, and I believe it to be true, with some real exceptions, and I'm prepared to concede that everybody in this room is an exception. But that makes this room a very unusual place to be. But what normally, you know, so for me, that's the system working as it should. The pressure is applied, and you respond to the pressure. Then what goes wrong is having appropriately responded to public concern. You then do one of two things. Either you pretend there was no change. You sort of hide the fact that you responded. Or you pretend that the change was your idea, you know. And instead of saying, well, yes, you know, Doug Powell pushed for it in Barf Blog, and eventually we decided we had to do it. You wind up saying we were going to do that anyway, and we would have done it quicker if those activists hadn't been the pain in the neck that they were. Does this ring a bell to people? I think it's extremely common for both industry and government to be responsive, which is, in my judgment, to your credit, and then pretend that they weren't. Which is part of what I really liked, Jane Billings, when you said that, you were criticized for your handling of SARS and were criticized for your handling of listeriosis and have taken those criticisms on board. And that sounded very natural coming from you. It didn't sound forced, and it was giving of credit. I don't know if you say the same things when you're talking to a less friendly audience, but those are, giving your critics credit for your achievements is a very effective way of reducing their outrage. Seizing the credit they deserve is a very effective way of exacerbating their outrage. Yes. Yeah, it's a tough question. Surrounding people who are outraged is a much larger group of people. If you call the people who are really outraged, call them fanatics. Okay? Surrounding the fanatics are a much larger group, maybe an order of magnitude bigger, of people that I call attentives. They are listening to your dialogue with the fanatic, with a lot of attention. And what they want, they're on a kind of a seesaw. They're torn. And what they want is to see you responding meaningfully to the fanatic. Okay. And what normally happens, Randy, in good risk communication, is you make real changes in response to fanatic pressure. Okay. The fanatics find those changes unsatisfactory. And they just ratchet up their demands. They demand ever more extreme, ever more unreasonable things. Actually, a lot of activists are very unhappy when companies make concessions because it takes the wind out of their sails, and they have their own. I'll work for anybody. I work with them too, and you know, they sit around saying, "Oh shit, they gave us what we asked for. Now what are we going to do?" So it's a tough moment for them. They tend to gin up new demand. Okay, and you know, so you haven't gotten anywhere vis-a-vis them. But there's this whole other group of people watching that interaction that are beginning to get the feeling that you are appropriately responsive and they are unsatisfiable. And the way risk controversies, including food risk controversies, are usually resolved is when the attentives have gotten bored. And when the attentives get bored, the fanatics have another meeting and say, this is no longer bringing in media coverage, this is no longer bringing in contributions, this is no longer bringing in new members, we have to reallocate our resources. It's not like they have a shortage of targets. The activists are just like companies. They have more investment opportunities than they have investment capital. And they just say, well, that's not a very good product line anymore. Greenpeace in the greatest of ease after one meeting can reassign 27 campaigners from X issue to Y issue based on good data, usually better data than you guys have, about how, you know, which issues are bringing in the things they care about, media coverage, membership, contribution. This is a long-winded answer, but the bottom line is, you need to be more attentive to the fanatics than their number or their unreasonableness and intransigence justifies, because the attentives are watching. And you need to be the last one in town to decide that the fanatics are nuts. There's a seesaw going on here. If you dismiss the fanatics as nuts, the rest of us see them as truth-tellers and whistleblowers and heroes. If, on the other hand, you are listening attentively to the fanatics, then we start rolling our eyes and shaking our head, and you can see this at public meetings. You know, everybody in the room except you and Susan, you know, Susan was my first wife's name. I like using her as the fanatic. Susan is still raising hell. Everybody else has lost interest in Susan's issue and wants to move on, and you are continuing to pay attention to Susan. And the minute, eventually you can give up on Susan, but you have to be the last person in the room to decide that Susan isn't worth listening to. And long after the rest of us are willing to move on, you need to still be paying attention to Susan, because we're only inclined to think she's a nut if you're not. The minute you start treating her as a nut, we start taking her seriously again. Okay. So, you have a fanatic department, just like you have people for whom the care and feeding of Brian is a full-time occupation, you should have people for whom the care and feeding of Susan is a full-time occupation. Does that make sense? Other comments? Yes. All right. For employees, it is mostly a precaution advocacy issue. You want them to take the risk more seriously. But there's an important way in which it is an outrage management issue for employees, and maybe two ways, but one that I really want to talk about. And that is, in any situation where I am insufficiently attentive to a risk, one of the possibilities is that I'm too apathetic about the risk. Another possibility is that I'm too outraged about the precaution. And when you look at employee safety, for example, the evidence is very clear that the dominant barrier to employees taking safety rules seriously is not that they don't take the risk seriously, it's that they hate the precaution. When you investigate carefully why employees don't wear their safety gear, the respirator makes me feel like I can't breathe, the hood is hot, the glasses are geeky, as very important reasons. And it's not, way back when, in the history of safety precautions, we persuaded people in dangerous places to wear hard hats. Okay. Anybody know the history of that? Very interesting. There's enormous resistance to wearing hard hats. People were proud of the fact that they were willing to have their skulls crushed. Okay. And the hard hat was seen as a symbol of cowardice. Okay? You know, look at him, he's wearing a hard hat. He's a, you know, afraid. Now, and you were considered a much less reliable colleague if you wouldn't wear a hard hat. This is by no means weird. I went through the same thing a decade ago with police departments wearing rubber gloves against HIV in blood-rich environments. Cops spent a lot of time with a lot of blood, and they didn't want to wear rubber gloves because it connoted fear of HIV, and they want, you know, I mean, you're not afraid of guns. How can you be afraid of HIV? So this was before I was doing it. My profession did two things to make hard hats acceptable. Okay? One, and you know both of these things, probably haven't ever considered what they accomplished. One is it became a very strict rule that you could only wear the hard hat in a high-risk environment. You know, you had to take your hard hat off as soon as you left the place that was dangerous. And it was very important to enforce that rule because as a result of that rule being enforced, the hard hat became a symbol of being somebody who works in dangerous places. And people even adopted the word as their name for themselves. I'm a hard hat. It's a stunning example of something insulting turning into something complimentary. The other thing we did is we put decals on hard hats. Decals that were symbols of belonging, you know, your company, your division, your organizational loyalty you put on your hard hat. And many organizations found that they got additional compliance with hard hat rules if you were allowed to individuate your hard hat, with the name of your sweetheart or the name of your dog or the name of your motorcycle, whatever it was you loved most. And that combination, it's now a symbol of courage and high risk rather than being a symbol of cowardice. It's a symbol of membership. Okay. You've got the same decals as your peers, as your buddies, and it's a symbol of individuation. You know, you have what makes you uniquely you. All of that's on your hard hat, and hard hats are now extremely popular and, you know, there's lots of trouble getting employees follow safety rules, but not the hard hat rule. So, I mean, you see the how that applies. So, we could sit there. I can't do it instantly, but we could sit there and figure out what is it going to take to build a safety culture within Maple Leaf or within any company. I've done this most with the mining industry, the mining industry kind of interesting. I mean, the mining industry is one of the relatively few industries I've worked with that was in so much trouble for its awful safety record that management actually started caring deeply about safety. They internalized that, and they really meant it, and they were really, really, really deeply concerned about safety, and their employees weren't. I mean, you don't normally become a miner if you're terribly worried about safety. You know, the military had the same problem trying to persuade fighter pilots to fly safely. You know, if you're a fighter pilot, safety is not one of your prime goals in life, and if you're a miner, safety is not one of your prime goals in life. And what we found is that, obviously you want to tell them about safety, but you usually want to sell safety precautions on grounds other than safety. And then cognitive dissonance sets in. If you can get people to follow a safety precaution for relatively irrelevant reasons, then thereafter, you can tell them this is actually because they're really worried about, they're getting their skulls crushed. As those of you who have ever studied psychology, attitudes follow behavior much more routinely than behavior follows attitudes. So you give them a bullshit reason for changing their behavior, and then you give them a good reason for thinking that was a good behavior, and you wind up with the values you wanted. But you don't usually sell the values as the root to the behavior. You sell the behavior as the root to the value. I'm worried about time. Do you want me to just keep going? You want me to stop? You're nodding your head and doing this at the same time. Okay. If you want to know about crisis communication, read the handouts, then go read the website. There's a lot of food-specific stuff on the website, but you don't need food-specific stuff. You guys will be able to make the translation. Thank you.